I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, targeting the top. New developments in Israel's efforts to eliminate one of the masterminds of the October 7th terror attack. Push for peace. Why several Israelis and Palestinians met with Pope Francis at the Vatican. Race for the White House. As the candidates remain busy on the campaign trail, we examine the trends from early voting in the state of Georgia. Plus, Happy Meal, a preview of the Al Smith Dinner, a fundraiser for Catholic charities in New York. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Ignatius of Antioch. Our top story tonight, Yahya Sinwar, top leader of Hamas and architect of the October 7th massacre, is dead. It is a huge development in the war between Israel and Hamas, and undoubtedly the most significant since the war began. The streets of Tel Aviv filled with supporters of Israeli hostages looking to bring their loved ones home. Sinwar was at the top of Israel's most wanted list since the war began over a year ago and is considered Israel's Osama bin Laden. The military confirmed Sinwar's death after conducting DNA tests on a body among three militants killed in an operation in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke after Sinwar's death was confirmed, saying the war is not yet over.
I'm standing before you today to inform you that Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar has been eliminated, the person who committed the most terrible massacre in the history of our nation since the Holocaust, the mass murderer who murdered thousands of Israelis and kidnapped hundreds of our citizens, was eliminated today by our heroic soldiers. And today, as we promised to do, we settled the account with him. Today, evil has suffered a heavy blow. But the task before us is not yet complete.
In a statement, President Biden called the killing of Sinwar, quote, a good day for Israel, for the United States, and for the world. He also called it an opportunity to free Israeli hostages. Vice President Kamala Harris also weighed in on the death of Sinwar.
Today, I can only hope that the families of the victims of Hamas feel a sense and measure of relief.
The vice president added the death of Sinwar is an opportunity to finally end the war in Gaza. The death of Hamas leader is a significant moment in Israel's year-long offensive against the militant group. Several U.S. lawmakers are calling it a great victory.
This would be a major victory for Israel and a victory for the world. Yahya Sinwar is the Osama bin Laden of his time. He is solely responsible for the attacks of October 7th, getting 1,200 Israelis killed, many of them civilians.
Well, House Speaker Mike Johnson and others applauded the killing of the leader, stating Sinwar's life was the embodiment of evil and marked by hatred for all that is good in the world. His death brings hope for all those who seek to live in freedom and relief to Israelis that he has sought to oppress. And Mike Turner from Ohio says justice has been served to Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar. He was the mastermind behind the horrific October 7th terrorist attack that killed more than 1,000 innocent Israeli men, women, and children. And for analysis, we turn now to Gaith Alamari, senior fellow at the Washington Institute and an expert on Arab-Israeli relations. Gaith, good to be with you as always. Let's talk about the significance of Yahya Sinwar's death to Israel and also the United States.
All right. Thank you very much. Look, I mean, this was a major development. Sinwar was the uncontested leader of Hamas. He enjoyed what no other Hamas leader enjoyed, which is credibility, both with Hamas's military wing and its political wing. He was the guy who was in charge of the day-to-day as well as the strategic operations of Hamas in Gaza and outside Gaza. And he was the main obstacle to reaching a hostage and a ceasefire deal, which is what the U.S. and Israel have been trying to do really since the beginning of this year. With his departure, In the short term, obviously, there will be a lot of instability and a lot of chaos. Yet, it's very unlikely that his successor will be able to take such a hard line as Sinwar did, particularly that his successor will likely come from the Hamas leadership that's based in Qatar, and they are more susceptible to pressure than Sinwar was.
Yeah, and I know you wrote about that today on X. What more do we know, Gaith, about the military strike that killed Sinwar, and how was Israel able to find him and eliminate him? Do you know?
I mean, we don't have full details yet, but from what I've seen so far, it seemed, frankly, more like an accident than a planned attack. I mean, Israel, just in context, the last few weeks has managed to pinpoint attack a lot of the Hezbollah leaders in Lebanon. In this particular case, it seems that a patrol stumbled upon him. There was a firefight, and he was killed. The Israelis knew the general area that he was in, but not his exact location, particularly that Hamas had built over the years a very extensive labyrinth of tunnels, and he was hiding there. When he surfaced, I think he was unlucky to stumble upon an Israeli patrol, and that was the end of him.
Yeah. You touched on the peace deal and also the hostages. Talk a little bit more about that and what Sinwar's death means in this process.
But first of all, Sinwar was the main obstacle to reaching a hostage deal. From his perspective, he felt the hostages were his strongest negotiating card, and he was unwilling to relinquish that. Now, with his death, things have changed. On the short term, I have to say I am worried. I'm worried that some of the lower-level Hamas militants who hold some of these hostages might kill some of them out of revenge or to send a message to Israel, there's a cost. But in the longer term, I think the new leader will find himself, first of all, not in full control of those on the ground and there, and therefore unable to, you know, leverage the hostages, but also will be in a very weak position. At the end of the day, Sinwar was in some tunnel in Gaza, and no amount of external pressure could move him. The new leaders sitting in Qatar, in Doha, are dependent on these, on that country, are open to Egyptian pressure. So the real challenge right now, or the opportunity rather, I would say, is for the United States, working with Israel and with our allies in Egypt and in Qatar and elsewhere, to basically start pushing the Hamas leadership to reach a deal. As you know, time is not on the hostages' side, and the sooner we get this kind of deal, not only will it be good for releasing the hostages, and that's a worthy cause in itself, but also that will be the prerequisite for reaching a ceasefire and ending this really tragic bloodshed that has impacted so many Palestinians and Israelis.
Okay, thank you so much for coming on. Always wonderful to get your perspective. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, here in the U.S. on the campaign trail, former President Donald Trump attends the Al Smith Dinner in New York, benefiting Catholic charities, while Vice President Kamala Harris holds three events in Wisconsin today, including a meet and greet with students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Both candidates also continue to hurl personal attacks at each other. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
That's right, Tracy. Good evening to you. The personal attacks are indeed flying fast and furious from both sides, as you mentioned. One very recent tweet from Vice President Kamala Harris reads, quote, "Donald Trump is increasingly unstable. He is unfit to be president of the United States." Trump also posting some harsh attacks.
On Truth Social, former President Donald Trump posts a comment ripping Vice President Kamala Harris, writing in part, "She is also the worst vice president in history." And as President Joe Biden left for Germany, I asked him to respond to that, and the vice president's decision to skip tonight's Al Smith Catholic Charity Dinner.
Sir, Donald Trump says Harris is the worst vice president in history.
Is it a mistake
for her not to go to Al Smith dinner?
Not clear whether the president heard my second question as he walked away. EWTN is scheduled to interview Trump just before the Al Smith dinner. You can watch that exclusive interview at 10 p.m. Eastern. Meanwhile, Trump's running mate, GOP vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance, stops in Pittsburgh to deliver remarks at a campaign event.
In 19 days, it's about Pennsylvanians saying, we're voting for our future, we're voting for prosperity for our children, and we're sure as hell not giving Kamala Harris a promotion to President of the United States.
Wednesday, Harris held her first interview with Fox News. She attacked Trump while defending the current administration's record on immigration.
The first bill, practically within hours of taking the oath, was a bill to fix our immigration system.
The vice president adding,
the strength of leadership is based on who you lift up. The strength of an American president, which is one who understands that the vast majority of us have more in common than what separates us.
Now an update for you. Vice President Kamala Harris plans to address the Al Smith Catholic Charity dinner by video, not attend, but address by video. Former President Trump still plans to attend in person. EWTN has submitted multiple requests for an interview with Kamala Harris, but has yet to receive an answer. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right. Thank you, Owen. And now let's turn to Andra Gillespie, professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Georgia, of course, a very important swing state in this year's presidential election. Professor Gillespie, good to have you back on. I want to talk about Peach State in just a minute. First, I want to get your impressions on last night's interview with Vice President Harris on Fox. How important do you think these sit-down interviews are for her now, especially in these final weeks before the election?
Well, I don't have any inside knowledge of what's going on in terms of Vice President Harris's strategy, but I suspect that she has ramped up her interviews so that they hit at a time when voters are actually paying attention to what's going on. She certainly garnered a lot of criticism in the past month, 6 weeks about not doing interviews, but maybe the idea was to wait until the final weeks of the election when people would be at peak attention and she would get a lot of earned media for these interviews, not just for the time that she's actually on camera with the reporter, but then also the analysis that takes place afterwards where they dilute everything into sound bites and then also regurgitate what had happened in some of these interviews.
Yeah, and what did you think of last night's interview? Your thoughts?
It was combative on both sides. And so it seemed like Vice President Harris was prepared for a fight. Bret Baier came in right out of the gate with a question that seemed to me to be setting up to another gotcha question on immigration. He certainly provided the type of red meat questions that a Fox News audience would want one of their reporters to ask of a presidential candidate. And Vice President Harris responded very vigorously in many instances. And so I don't think that many people were persuaded by the interview. So I don't think that a typical Fox News voter was going to be persuaded to not vote for Donald Trump because of that interview. But I think that Democrats were energized by the fact that Kamala Harris stood up to Bret Baier, and inserted herself, tried not to let him talk over her and other kinds of things. So I think that people got what they wanted to see out of it. And I think that she fulfilled her purpose by showing up on what could be perceived as a hostile news network and holding her own.
I want to talk about Georgia now. Former President Trump did a town hall with Harris Faulkner, speaking of Fox News, in your state this week. It was specifically geared towards women. I want to talk about that, Professor. How important is the female vote in this race? And any indication how women voters in Georgia may be leaning?
Well, women tend to vote at slightly higher rates than men. In particular, and when we're looking at communities of color, that gets amplified even more, particularly amongst African-American women. So for Black women in particular, if they turn out at low rates, even if they vote overwhelmingly for Kamala Harris, it's going to jeopardize her chances of being able to win the state of Georgia. Keep in mind that Democrats are still outnumbered in the state of Georgia, so they win because of a compromised Republican candidate and superior turnout. And so it becomes a question as to whether or not Georgia voters think Donald Trump is as compromised now as he was in 2020, and whether or not Democrats can actually get people to turn out to vote.
Yeah, almost out of time here. Quickly, I know the early voting is underway in Georgia, and Georgia state officials said on the first day of early voting that a record 328,000 ballots were cast. What are you seeing there on the ground?
So as of yesterday, there's a website that keeps track of this. There have been over 600,000 votes cast. There were about 5 million cast in Georgia during the 2020 cycle. So this suggests that perhaps about 10% of Georgia voters or more have already cast their ballots. I know from a polling that my own research center has done that people who participate in early voting do so because it's convenient. And that this is also a reflection that many voters have made up their minds already and they don't need the next 3 weeks to wait for any October surprises to make up their mind about who they're going to vote for. They've known for a long time who they're supporting. So it's just a question of can the campaigns get these people to turn out to vote? And whichever one does the best job is going to be the one that wins.
Okay, Professor Gillespie, always good to be with you. Thank you so much for your input.
Thank you.
An independent panel formed after the first assassination attempt against former President Trump is calling for a major shakeup of the Secret Service. A 52-page report issued earlier today concludes that the Secret Service needs, quote, a fundamental reform. It urges the Secret Service to bring in new outside leadership and to make major changes in how candidates are protected. The panel warns without these changes, the assassination attempts can and will happen again. President Joe Biden ordered the panel to investigate the attempted assassination of Trump. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including new funding, why FEMA says it needs more money, and how lawmakers are responding. Welcome back. Some lawmakers believe Congress should return to Washington, D.C. early from their break and provide more funding for disaster relief efforts in North Carolina and other states hit hard by two recent hurricanes. Some say if not, disaster relief efforts could stall. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now in the studio with that story. Eric.
Well, good evening, Tracy. Yes, this is an issue that's not just about FEMA, as I reported, the funds are running low, but also about the Small Business Administration. It's currently out of money for its disaster assistance loans. The situation is now delaying much-needed relief for people applying for aid in the wake of the damage caused by the recent hurricanes. Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina says this should have been taken care of months ago by Congress.
We should not have even been having a discussion about going back and plussing up SBA, we knew that we were going to run out of money. Now we have.
Right.
And I was trying to explain to my colleagues who've said it's only 3 weeks, we can come back. You go tell that to people who may be without power for the next 3 or 4 months.
You may recall Congress passed a $20 billion bill last month for FEMA's disaster response, but it did not include any new money for the Small Business Administration Disaster Fund. Senator Tillis is not alone. Senators Rick Scott, Marco Rubio, and others have introduced a new bill to get more funds. Senator Scott said in a statement, quote, I hope that none of our colleagues in the Senate will object to the quick passage of this needed funding. Even with this bill, I continue to urge Majority Leader Schumer to bring back the Senate to fully fund other disaster relief functions at the SBA. How important is the Small Business Administration funding? In 2023, it provided nearly $3 billion in loans to disaster survivors. Senator Tillis says Congress needs to step up now.
So I think we've just got to, be unapologetic, charge in there, plus up the disaster relief funding, the recovery funding, and the Small Business Administration. Mm-hmm.
And so far, according to the SBA's own statistics, it's seen around 50,000 applications for those impacted by the hurricanes and made more than 700 Hurricane Helene loan offers, totaling more than $48 million. SBA says that they will continue to process applications but can't provide any loans until Congress replenishes the funds. Tracy?
All right. Thank you so much, Eric. And up next on EWTN News Nightly, questions at the Senate. In the third week of meetings, we examine some of the main topics under discussion in the global gathering. Plus, lawmakers in Italy pass a new measure, and it has to do with surrogacy. We have the details. Lawmakers in Italy approve a measure to criminalize those who go abroad to have children through surrogacy. Residents who violate the measure could face up to 2 years in prison and could pay up to $1 million in fines. Though the law applies equally to all couples, same-sex couples say they would be the hardest hit. Meantime, Pope Francis is calling for a universal ban on surrogacy, saying that it amounts to, quote, the commercialization of pregnancy. The Archdiocese of Los Angeles agrees to pay $880 million to victims of clergy sexual abuse. Archbishop Jose Gomez says that he hopes the settlement will provide a measure of healing to victims. The suit will address more than 1,300 abuse claims filed against the Archdiocese. Are we approaching the end of the third week of the Synod on Synodality in Rome? Two recent forums have focused on addressing some specific themes. The relationship between local churches and the universal church is one of the main topics, and it continues to raise many questions. And joining us now from Rome is Frank Rocca, senior Vatican analyst for EWTN News. Frank, great to be with you as always. So tell us, what are the bishops and other members of the Synod talking about at their assembly in Rome?
Well, some of the more controversial issues that came up a lot last year, women's ordination or LGBT issues, have been taken off the table by the Pope, who handed them over to special study groups that will report on their work next year. So probably the most intensely discussed issue this year so far has been decentralization in the church and where it's appropriate and how far it can go.
Yeah, and Frank, tell us a little bit more about that and what that means for the universal church.
The sticking point is whether national bishops' conferences can have doctrinal authority. Can they teach collectively? And Pope Francis has called from the start of his pontificate for them to have more of that authority. But there are people who worry, and this was discussed yesterday, they are worried that the church will be fragmented, that you could have something that's prohibited in one part of the world and blessed in the other, for example, like same-sex blessings. So that's a concern, and there's a worry that it could lead, the decentralization could lead to disunity. And some people look at other churches, for example, the United Methodist Church, which is split over teachings on sexuality, and the Anglican Communion, which is in the process of doing so. So they worry about that danger.
Yeah, and Frank, before I let you go, what can we expect from this coming week, as it will be the last of the Synod?
That's right. Well, most of the upcoming week will be devoted to preparing the Synod's final report, which is expected to come out on the last working day, Saturday, the 26th of October. And it will be interesting to see. Last year, the LGBT issues that were discussed didn't come up, and that was a source of some controversy itself. And it's also a question as to what weight the Pope will decide to give to this final report. He could choose to declare it a magisterial document, part of that it will have weight as doctrine, or he may just take it as input for his eventual post-synodal apostolic exhortation, which will be a papal document.
All right, Frank, thank you so much for joining us. As always, we really appreciate it. Frank Rocca, senior Vatican analyst for EWTN News. Thank you so much. Well, finally tonight, Pope Francis meets with Israeli and Palestinian representatives at the Vatican in an effort to bring peace to the Middle East. Attendees included a former Israeli prime minister, former Palestinian foreign minister, and Israeli peace advocate Gershon Baskin, a frequent guest here on EWTN News Nightly. Former Israeli prime minister Ehud Olmert called the meeting, quote, important and emotional. He also said the Holy Father was presented with a peace proposal for Gaza. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.